Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today, we are joined by Professor Adriana Brodsky of St. Mary's College of Maryland, who will be speaking to us about her new book, Sephardi, Jewish, Argentine, Community and National Identity. It's a really fascinating book that tells the story of Jewish immigration from around the Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Middle East to Argentina at the turn of the 20th century. And it examines how they constructed their own complex identities in the decades that followed. Adriana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Robin. I'm very happy to be here with you and your listeners.
It's a pleasure to have you. Before we delve into the book, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm an Argentine native. I was born in Buenos Aires. And I first studied English and went in to learn how to teach it as a foreign language. So that was my first career teaching English as a foreign language, both to high school students as well as business people and the like. I also loved history, had always loved history, and went back to the teacher training college where I had finished my degree at and did a specialization in history. So I ended up teaching history to future teachers of English as a foreign language. So I was able to combine both my love of the English language as well as the love of history, even though I was not working, I was not doing any research at the time. I thought of, you know, I think I've realized that that is where my next steps were going to take me. So I decided to apply to grad school in the United States and was accepted at Duke, where I studied under both Danny James and John French, who were the Latin American historians at Duke. John French is still there, but Danny James has gone on to Indiana University. So I came to the United States to do my PhD, and the rest is history, I guess.
Wonderful. And so I guess with that said, the next natural step is what brought you to write Sephardi, Jewish, and Argentine? What are the questions that you set out to answer and why?
So my family in Argentina is what is called we call it in Spanish, café con leche, a family that's coffee and milk. And I guess that kind of makes reference to, you know, to kind of racial stereotypes about Jews. But it also suggests the sort of the combination of two groups that are different. And so my mother's family is originally from Morocco, from Spanish-speaking Morocco, Tetuan. And my father's family is originally from, I think, present-day Ukraine. And so I grew up knowing that these two families had different traditions and kind of really not understanding, you know, why that was. why, you know, some holidays seemed so different depending on who I was spending them with. But there was also a sense that I could figure out that the Sephardi part of my family was the one that was least understood by my friends. And so Sephardim are a minority in Argentina. And so that kind of sense of difference, of almost foreignness, you know, to Ashkenazim about what Sephardim, about Sephardi, Sephardi culture, about Sephardi practices, that intrigued me. But then I also, whenever I would talk to, you know, to my grandmother, and I would say, well, you know, I have another Sephardi friend, you know, who's from, you know, her grandparents came from, you know, from Turkey, and she'd say, oh, well, no, we're different than them. I'm like, so everybody's different. So I was also then confronted by this, you know, these large distinctions between Ashkenazim and Sephardim seemed to mean a difference. But then whenever I try to group all the non-Ashkenazim together, my grandmother would always remind me that, well, not all Sephardim come from the same place. Not all Sephardim have the same traditions. And so this sort of this labeling, this sense of commonality, the absence of commonality, the stressing of difference, even within the group identified as Sephardim, I think, like, stayed with me. And this book is an attempt at trying to figure these larger questions out. So what brought Sephardim together to act as Sephardim vis-a-vis Ashkenazim? And that is, I mean, as I said, I think the book is the answer to some of these questions that my family and my living in a café con leche family reminded me of.
Right. And so how did you go about trying to answer these questions then? You know, what archives did you use, or what were your steps in figuring out these answers?
I started just working with my mom's community, with the Moroccan community, because I was known, I could be introduced. And so I wasn't, you know, in a sense, a foreigner trying to come in and look at, you know, their archives. And and that was, I think, a good move, and something that it was also strange to find that you always needed to come with somebody that could introduce you. These are community archives. In most cases, these community archives are religious institutions that have also social outreach. But there was a sense of if not fear, people did not know what it meant that I was going to be doing research. And so I always needed, you know, that for somebody to introduce me and to say, you know, it's okay for this person to be looking at, you know, our minute books. Or so, starting with the Moroccan community, which was the easiest one for me to access, then I sort of created a network of research assistants, as I call them, friends who, people who are members of these communities that I started meeting, and then requested that they introduce me to the authorities of these organizations. And that network then allowed me entry into these communities' archives. And so I was, that was essential. Right. Otherwise, with these networks, I could not have done what I did. And there were still, you know, some communities that, you know, that it was almost impossible for me to get to know somebody that would introduce me. And so, for those communities, I had to rely on what other historians had, you know, had to say about them. that I also went to Israel. Some of the material about Argentine Sephardim made it to Israel. Mm. And so that was another place that I sought. And so there are very few institutional archives about Sephardi Jewish life in Argentina. Well, there are no central archives that have compiled all the primary sources about Sephardi communities. And so mm-hmm. they're still pretty much in the hands of religious, social, and philanthropic organizations, as well as in people's living room, furniture, right. People that have collected, because they were themselves involved in, pamphlets and things like that. And so the need of creating a group, a network, and sort of talking to people and letting them know what you're doing, that was then essential at also uncovering those family or personal archives of people who had been involved and were willing then to share what they had with me.
Right. It sounds like it really involved sort of building a rapport with members of the community.
Yep.
Interesting.
Exactly. Exactly.
I wonder if maybe we should take a step back, and I wonder if you could give our listeners a quick history lesson on, first of all, perhaps on Sephardim, on Sephardi Jews, and also on the Sephardim specifically of Argentina, why Sephardim chose to immigrate to Argentina, why they left where they had been before.
So, people usually describe the Sephardim as sort of those Jews who had settled in the Iberian Peninsula after the expulsion from Eretz Israel. And then after they sort of, stayed in the peninsula, they developed, customs, traditions there. After 1492, with the arrival of the Spanish king and queen and the Inquisition, they were expelled from Spain, which initiated the Sephardi diaspora in the early modern period. And so Jews then moved into areas in the Mediterranean. Significant number went and settled in the Ottoman Empire, invited by the Ottoman leadership. They also went into parts of Northern Europe. And it is the Sephardim that are actually going to move to Argentina, which was much later on in the very late 19th century and early 20th century, where part of that Sephardi diaspora that had left Spain to settle in these other areas. And so those Jews that came to Argentina, the earliest group were the Moroccans, Moroccan Jews that started moving into the Americas in some places very early on in the 19th century. There's references to Moroccan Jews in the Amazon at around mid 19th century, in Argentina, they're certainly the first reference to an organized Sephardi community is a group of Moroccan Jews that request permission to hold religious services. And then what we have is sort of movement of other Sephardi Jews coming from present-day Turkey, Rhodes, who are in many cases sort of trying to find better economic opportunities, as well as escaping forced military service in some cases. We have, that is a large part of the Sephardim come from, was not yet Turkey, but, present day Turkey and Rhodes and Salonika. Now, the largest group of non-Ashkenazim, and so here is where, you know, in some places, you know, this group that I will define right now would perhaps not be considered Sephardim, because these were the Arabic speakers, Jews from Aleppo and Damascus, some of whom were probably had never left, right, that area. They had never been part of that Sephardi diaspora. People call them Mizrahim, but in Argentina, that is a word that was never used to define or to describe these Jews, and they came to label themselves, and they came to be labeled as Sephardim as well. So the largest group are actually the Arabic speakers, both from Aleppo and Damascus. So, and then there were other smaller groups of Sephardi Jews from Italy, Bulgaria, Samarkand, and other places in the Mediterranean. But the biggest groups then are the Moroccan, the Ladino speakers from present-day Turkey, and the Arabic speakers from Aleppo and Damascus. And what is interesting is that as you see them arriving, they're not seeking each other out except for their own, right? So in a sense, these groups act very much like the sort of the sense of the like the Landsmannschaften from Ashkenazim, right? So Moroccan Jews are going to seek out Moroccan Jews. Those who are coming in from Izmir or from Constantinople, you know, they're going to search those that are from the same place. They, in many cases, right, it's the family groups, people that are going first and then urging other family members to join them in Argentina. So we have kind of family chain migration. But they seldom, at the very beginning, they seldom seek other groups out, right? So these different Sephardi groups settle in different parts of the city. They found their own institutional centers, religious, of course, but social, philanthropic, and seldom seek each other out. So one of the processes that I track throughout the book is, when is it, right, that these that there is a desire to start thinking outside of these groups that have just until that point gathered only, right, Moroccan Jews. So at what moments, right, do they look out and seek connections with others, both other Sephardim, but then other others like Ashkenazim, and then non-Jews. So I would say that the whole book tries to track down this process of when is it that they imagine themselves part of larger groups than the one that they have naturally gathered around.
Right. And I think this comes through really vividly in your discussion of cemeteries. I can, you know, that's a very visual discussion, as well as in your discussion of philanthropic organizations. I wonder if you could start by expanding on that part of your discussion with us.
Yes, I was, my mother's family belonged to the Moroccan community. That was the first Sephardi cemetery in the city of Buenos Aires. And I remember that I attended it and I was surprised by the existence of a separate section that was not the Moroccan, that did not belong to the Moroccan community, that in fact had belonged to this organization of called Sfi Migdal, which was a group of men, women, who had founded brothels and where there, you know, there were women working for them as prostitutes. And so I was intrigued by, you know, this section of Jews, right? So it's non-consecrated land. It's not Catholic. It's not been blessed by the Catholic authorities. And so it's Jewish land, but then it's Jewish, but they're different. And so they're, you know, next to, it's you know, beyond walled, a walled section. So I was really intrigued by the sort of the construction of these walls that separated some Jewish dead from other Jewish dead. And as I started thinking and digging deep into this, you know, there's five Sephardi cemeteries in the city of Buenos Aires, one for each group that settled in the city. And then as you move out of the city of Buenos Aires and you go to other parts of Argentina, you find in many cases, you still find that division. You find, you know, cemeteries that were created both by Ashkenazim and Sephardim together. They've bought land together, or in some cases, they one of the communities bought land but sold, you know, a section, a part of it to the other group. But still the sections are walled. And so, it was really fascinating to me to explore the concrete meaning of the walls, but as well as the symbolic meaning of those walls. This sense of difference that was translated even into the dead. And so you see moments in which they are trying to come together to pool their resources and to buy land, which is not something very cheap, especially given the fact that, you know, the Jewish tradition requires that you can't just, you need more and more land as the communities, you know, grow. And so the sense that what brought them together, what allowed for people to solve the issue of cemeteries by seeking alliances, by seeking ways of working together. And then still, right, they felt like they had to mark the difference by building some of these walls, internal walls within the cemeteries. And that is also something that you see when it comes to philanthropy, right? So it wasn't only the dead that kind of were separated from each other, but, you know, some of these institutions, right, sort of were created to also keep the living, right, separate. But again, I was struck by the ways in which Jews sort of felt that they were part of a variety of different groups, if you were. So you have philanthropic organizations and trying to follow and chart who it is that they are deciding to help. Where is the flow of support going to? I realized that is also a way of trying to understand who these Jews felt a connection to, or a sense of community with. And so you have philanthropic organizations in the interior cities of Argentina sort of sending money to Jewish institutions in Buenos Aires. You have philanthropic organizations in interior cities sending support to other Jewish organizations in other interior cities in Argentina. You have Jewish institutions, Sephardi institutions in Argentina sending money back home, and back home meant across the Atlantic, supporting schools, supporting the building of local cemeteries back across the Atlantic. You have connections between these Argentine Sephardi organizations and Israel. Institutions in Israel. Of course, then not Israel. And then you also have they're interestingly, you know, Jewish philanthropic organizations supporting non-Jewish institutions or in Argentina. So, and I thought that, well, I mean, you have in many cases, you know, Sephardi religious organizations were also neighborhood organizations, and so you see the organizations in the neighborhood of La Boca, for example, a religious organization, participating and donating money to the police station, to the social sports club in the neighborhood, which are not Jewish, but that also signaled to me a sense of feeling like they were part of these other communities, that they were part of this neighborhood that had these other organizations that were not Jewish, but that in a sense, you know, made them feel part of this larger society. And so the ways in which I thought who was helping who gave us a good sense of the levels of belonging and who these Sephardi Jews, which groups these Sephardi Jews felt part of. And that included people from the same town, people from the same town, but who lived in different parts of Argentina. It meant still being connected to institutions and the community back home across the Atlantic. It meant being linked to Jewish presence in Israel. It meant also being connected with non-Jews in the neighborhood or in the city. And so I looked at philanthropy as a way of identifying the sense of belonging and these lines and levels of belonging.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, it seems very layered. So, right. And you also talk about how, you know, there is this sort of cohesion, but there is also a sort of disunity that becomes more and more pronounced as individuals and groups try to make sort of all-encompassing Sephardi organizations, and that these efforts ultimately often failed. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
Right. So what you see in the case of philanthropy is different, right? So from these organizations that are attempting to gather all Sephardim to act in the name of all Sephardim, right? Philanthropic groups tend to be, you know, groups that are grounded in these individual communities defined by the origin, by their origin. In this other chapter, what I look at is attempts that made by Sephardim to create an institution that would represent them as a whole, right, as one. So creating a sort of a single voice. And the reasons why there were these attempts were internal and they were different. So on the first case, they attempted to create a religious central organization so that issues of ritual, right, could be addressed. That rather than, you know, requiring sort of consultation with a bet din back home, that there was a sense that maybe a Sephardi religious rabbinical organization would be created so that those issues could be addressed much more simply. And you have to remember that in many cases these Sephardim are settling in Argentina without any rabbinical oversight. And I found several instances of letters in which these people are writing from places that are far away from Buenos Aires, which perhaps had, you know, rabbis or people who were well-versed in ritual and tradition, you know, asking, well, what do we do when, you know, a Jewish man has married a non-Jewish woman? Could we bury the non-Jewish woman in the cemetery? Could their child attend our religious school? And so these were some of the issues that that first organization attempted to solve or to, yeah, to create a, you know, an institution that would provide that type of rabbinic leadership that they thought was needed. And you can sense that there was a desire to have somebody that could answer these questions for these communities that are pretty much on their own, creating religious organizations without the support. And so, so that, you know, that was one of the attempts in 1927. But eventually that, you know, that kind of fails. And one of the reasons that I think it sort of explains that failure is the fact that even though there seemed to have been a need for religious leadership, the communities that had been created in Argentina had developed along ley lines, and so there was no there was no religious leadership that had been there from the very beginning. There are a couple of exceptions, and the Arabic speakers tended to be a little bit more religious, and so they did develop sort of religious a bet din that that addressed those issues within their own community. But what I felt was that the Sephardim in general said, if we're going to create perhaps a single voice, that single voice does not need to be a religious voice. We are lay communities. Lay in the sense of what is going to define us is not necessarily our religious practices.
Okay, it's like being Moroccan or being Turkish or Ottoman. It's
exactly, right. exactly. And so there were also issues of personality. The rabbi that had been chosen to lead this religious institution clashed with many of the lay leaders that resented having a religious leader tell them what to do. So that was an internal need, sort of a desire, perhaps, to have a religious leadership that then made them realize that no, we do not want a religious leader. We much rather continue dealing with these issues of ways in which we have maybe not very effectively, but we've dealt with it before. We'll continue to deal with that. The second institution that they attempted to create was a confederation of Sephardi institutions, which the intention of that, Sephardim felt that Ashkenazim were not taking them seriously, that Ashkenazim had all these ideas about what Sephardim were like, and that they needed to get to, Sephardim needed to get together to push back against some of these generalizations that the Ashkenazim were making. And so what is interesting here is that what brings them together is a desire to act together vis-a-vis the Ashkenazim, to be able to, they say, defend ourselves against what Ashkenazim were saying about them. It's interesting that that what brings them together is the outside and the sort of the threat of the threat that if they do not band together their voices as individual groups, you know, from Morocco, from Turkey, from Syria, that would not be a strong enough of a defense, and that if they came together, that they would be more effective at preventing Ashkenazim to continue saying what they were saying about them. And the interesting thing is that, you know, that kind of that attempt fails because the Ashkenazim at the same time are also attempting to create institutions that will represent all Jews in Argentina. And so Sephardim, I think, felt like they could not have this separatist move going on when it was clear also that the Argentine Jewish community did require an organization that would speak on behalf of all Jews to the Argentine government. And so eventually, right, this single Jewish organization will be created in Argentina. And so I think that this Sephardi attempt at creating a Sephardi institution fails because they decide that, you know, pursuing perhaps the Jewish institution or the institution that would represent all Jews would be welcome, and that it was necessary, and that, you know, insisting on a separatist organization would was not the way to go.
Right. So I'm thinking of how you talk, especially in the opening of your book, about how Sephardim were a little bit more invisible in Argentinian society than Ashkenazim, and how that was in some ways to their advantage. But it seems like in other ways they wanted to maintain this distinction and be remain visible.
Yes. Right. That is right. And that is, you know, that is always the line that they will that they will walk. And in some cases they will decide that, well, yes, you know, maybe we do need to continue to just not be very visible, or to just, you know, be within our own individual, you know, communities of origin. But then in some other moments they do realize that, you know, that it is important and it is strategic to actually come together to act as one. So yes, and so in the last case, the last attempt at coming together happens in connection with the Holocaust and a desire to come together and organize Sephardim in order to help Sephardim who had suffered during the Shoah. Okay. As well as attempt to be a little bit more efficient at supporting all Sephardim in Argentina. So so both concerned about those who had suffered during the war, and then those in Argentina to create some more central institutions that would make it easier for Sephardim to help Sephardim in Argentina as well. And that eventually, I mean, as I said, all these institutions fail. This, as I said, the line, navigating this line between we are very interested in keeping our own identities alive, identities as Moroccan Jews, identities as, you know, Ottoman, you know, Jews, identity as Aleppoan Jews, their desire to keep that and to defend that and to preserve that, sort of acting in some moments and deciding that, well, there are moments in which it might be better to override our differences and to think about ourselves as one. And so these were the cases in which they thought it would be best to think of themselves as one. And they were very short-lived.
I mean, there are so many complex elements and layers being added to these identities. It's no wonder that, you know, there are tensions. I guess to add one more layer, you talk about the role that Zionism played in the history of this population. I wonder if you could tell us about how that enters into this history.
Yes, I actually would say that if there was, one moment in which Sephardim could come together and act as one, it was in the realm of Zionism, because they did find they found Zionist centers, and all Sephardi groups participated in them, and so this is one of the. One of the issues that brought them together, And what is interesting is that, I mean, I found that what is interesting is that if you were to ask, members of the Ashkenazi, communities, if Sephardim had been involved in Zionism, their response would be no. I mean, they had become invisible even to Ashkenazim. And so I thought this is a story that really needs to be told over and over, that Sephardim were seriously involved in Zionism. They related to Zionism differently from the way in which Ashkenazim did. So here what we see is that amongst Sephardim, the sort of the notion of different Zionist parties doesn't play out. Sephardim decide to remain outside these political distinctions, and they very clearly from day one, they want to act as Sephardim, sort of outside of the political arena of political parties, and they want to act as Sephardim. And what has guided them was a fear that if they did not do that, if they did not found Sephardi Zionist institutions and demand that their help be recorded as coming from Sephardim in Argentina, in this case, that their efforts would be erased, that their efforts would not be visible. And so that is what is driving their participation, that they're aware that if they do not leave behind evidence of how Sephardim were mobilizing to help with the creation of the state, that help would not be visible, that it would not be recorded. And so they spend a lot of energy. They spent a lot of energy and a lot of time raising money and demanding that the Federation of Zionist Institutions in Argentina record their entry as the money that was raised by Sephardim, keeping always evidence of how much they were working for the state. And so what is interesting in the case of Zionism is that this is, right, one of the moments in which their desire for visibility in the creation of the state is what makes them forget about all these internal differences and come together and organize events, fundraising events, and raise money and be part of the what they call the rebirth of the national project. So we see them extremely active in Zionism, which is unfortunately, even though the Sephardim put so much energy in trying to make their contribution visible, it seems not to have actually been visible by those at the time, and even by scholars. Scholars do not tend to devote that much time to digging and trying to uncover that story of Sephardi participation in the Zionist movement.
Right. And you also talk about how women were involved in the Sephardi Zionist movement, but also in a number of Sephardi organizations and associational life.
Yes. They were central, even though, of course, they weren't imagined to be to be fulfilling these roles that contributed to these organizations, but they were probably not imagined as playing a central role, and that is why it's important that we recover the centrality of what it is that they did, especially because a lot of these philanthropic organizations that I talked about in one chapter, most of them were actually led, but most of the fundraising was actually done by the women. they were the ones that were doing the work behind the scenes for these organizations to have the money with which to help others. And so women are central in allowing these philanthropic organizations to distribute aid. And they are central also in preserving both individual identities from these communities of origin, as well as, you know, for stressing the sort of the Jewish identity as well. So I look at organizations that allowed for Jewish kids to remain within Jewish orphanages. That is to say, allowing for Jewish children to be born and raised, or to be raised in Jewish contexts, as opposed to, being in institutions that were not Jewish. So they were central in providing some of these services that made it possible for Jews to continue being Jews, or to receiving some of these services in Jewish institutions as opposed to non-Jewish institutions. And of course, as well as, you know, making it possible for Jews to continue with their own individual community of origin identity as well. So I see them sort of fulfilling these two roles making it possible for Jews to continue being Jewish in Argentina, as well as for some of these Sephardi groups to continue being Jews from, right, Morocco, Jews from these other places as well. And what is fascinating as well is that, you know, they're carrying out these goals of keeping Jewish identity alive, keeping individual Jewish identities alive, by copying, right, these Argentine female organizations. Sort of celebrating, right, the sort of, or having fundraising events in the same places where these Argentine philanthropic non-Jewish organizations are organizing their own events. So mirroring the established Argentine non-Jewish female organizations, but using them, I mean, for the Jewish women, using these places and these traditions and these practices in order to stress the Jewish identity and the specific Jewish identity of Jews from Morocco, for example.
I wonder, just because I found this part particularly fascinating, I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your examination of how food speaks to how women sort of navigated and, I guess, negotiated their various identities and affiliations.
Right. So I was always intrigued, right, by the ways in which Sephardi women would talk about their own culinary traditions, and they would be pretty quick to, you know, to say, well, that's not my food. That's not what we cook. That's not what we eat. And so that food really did become a symbol for these communities' identities and the ways in which then, you know, women, by cooking, right, these traditions and passing them on to future generations, how central that was, you know, for the maintenance of these particular Sephardi identity, and particular to these groups. And I got to taste the most fabulous food.
Oh, I can imagine. What a dream project in terms of food.
Yes.
And so your book closes with an examination of institutional practices. So you look at education and marriage and what those institutions tell us about how the community's identity sort of evolved over time. I wonder if you could finish by talking with us about that.
Yeah, and I will start by giving you again another little story that fueled my desire to delve into these issues. And so I remembered asking when I was a young child, my grandmother, what she remembered whenever she met my dad. So what I was intrigued about, you know, how was my father introduced into my mom's family? And I remember that my grandma was very, very open about it. And she said she was shocked when she learned that, you know, my dad was a Russo, was a Russian Jew. You know, at that time, to me, growing up in a Jewish community where these distinctions between, I mean, I was not paying attention to whether my Jewish friends were, you know, Ashkenazim or Sephardim. That was not a question that I, you know, that would come to my mind. But it clearly did to her. And it really did matter to her when she met my dad. And so I was intrigued, just like I had been intrigued about the issue of borders and walls in cemeteries. I was really struck by almost a sense that it wasn't a marriage that was frowned upon by no means, but that the first reaction had been, well, he's a Russo, he's a Russian Jew,
right? An outsider, I suppose.
An outsider, right? An outsider. My grandmother, of course, had married somebody from the same town that her parents were from. My grandmother was born in Argentina, but she married a fellow, somebody who her parents knew back from Tetuan, from the town where they had lived. And so, you know, I can imagine, you know, sort of now sort of thinking about and studying and realizing how central, right, their identity as Moroccan Jews had been, as opposed to, you know, part of this larger Argentine Jewish community, or even part of this larger Sephardi community, you know, to them, their sense of who was them and who was, you know, who was us and who was them was very clear. And certainly Russian Jews were not part of the group that they thought, you know, as us. And so I was very intrigued about who had married who when. And so I delved into marriage records to try to figure out when is it that that Sephardi individual Sephardi groups start, in a sense, crossing the aisle and marrying members, not members of their own group. And what is interesting is that in many cases, what you see is a lot more marriage to Ashkenazim than marriage to other Sephardim from other Sephardi groups. And so you see that if there is a crossing of the aisle, if there begin to be marriages outside of that immediate group of belonging, that is most likely going to be marriages with Ashkenazim than with other Sephardi groups from different origins.
So someone from Constantinople is less likely to marry someone from Salonika than they are someone whose family is from Ukraine.
And it would depend on which congregation, you know, they attended. Some of the Salonican Jews attended a congregation, usually with other members of the Ottoman. But it would be like, you know, between Moroccans and you know, yeah, Izmir Jews, that almost never happened. Which then reminded me, right, that what is happening is that this generation of Argentine Jews that are being raised in Argentina or attending institutions where they're perhaps much more likely to meet Ashkenazi Jews than they are to meet other Sephardim from other communities of origin. And so it's interesting to think about then the role that, you know, institutions that are allowing for the coming together of different groups, and the role that then Argentina has, Argentina and Argentine institutions has in all this, right? So a lot of these marriage partners are found in Argentine university, right? So when these kids are attending university, that's when they're meeting, known Moroccan partners, say. And because the Ashkenazi, the Ashkenazi group is much larger than, it's significantly bigger than the Sephardi community, if they aren't encountering other Jews, it is very likely that they are encountering Ashkenazi Jews.
So it might not be deliberate so much as...
Right.
Statistically more likely.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. But then, you know, the other sense is that, you know, these Jewish young people are also changing the way in which how they see themselves. Right. So more and more these children that are choosing right partners across the aisle are finding themselves thinking of themselves as Argentine Jews much more than their parents or the previous generations, who perhaps imagined themselves as being not, I mean, yes, you know, yes, Argentine Jews overall, but really, 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 right, members of the Moroccan community or members of the, the Syrian community from Aleppo. Or so what we see, I think, also in their choice of marriage partners that are sort of expanding outside of these smaller communities of origin is a sense that there's something that's uniting, right, these young men and women, and is their sense of being Argentine Jews much more than members of their parents' communities of origin.
Their worlds are just getting bigger.
Yes. Exactly right.
Fascinating. So Adriana, we've taken up a lot of your Sunday morning, but I want to know what you're working on next.
I am looking at that generation of Sephardi Jews that are born in Argentina and who begin to navigate this sort of fine line between continuing to feel themselves as part of these individual Sephardi communities of origin and members of the Argentine Jewish community, and their decision to become part of the Zionist movement and become part of Zionist youth groups, and deciding to actually make Aliyah, to move to Israel, starting with the creation of the state in 1948 onwards until 1970, the early part of the 1970s. So I'm kind of following, you know, this generation who decides to, members of this generation who decide to go and live in Israel, or those who had started thinking about that and decide to remain in Argentina as well. So the ways in which Argentine identity gets reconfigured once they move to Israel, and the ways in which they're thinking about moving to Israel, working for moving to Israel, but remaining in Argentina also shapes the Argentine community through their actions as well. So it's a study on Argentine Jewish Sephardi youth and their desires to move to Israel.
That sounds like a fascinating almost sequel to this project.
Exactly. That's how I see it.
I really look forward to reading that. Adriana, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much, Robin, and very happy to have been here with you and all the listeners.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That was Adriana Brodsky speaking with us about her new book, Sephardi Jewish Argentine, Community and National Identity, which is available through Indiana University Press. If you like listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, please do consider subscribing. And please rate us wherever you get your podcasts. We really appreciate hearing from you guys. Thanks for tuning in.